The rim of the ring world grew from a dim line occluding a few stars to a black wall. A wall 1,000 miles high, featureless, though any features would have been blurred by speed. 500,000 miles away, blocking 90 degrees of sky, the wall sped past at a hellish 770 miles per second. Its edges converged to vanishing points, to points at infinity at either end of the universe, and from each point at infinity a narrow line of baby blue shot straight upward. To look into the vanishing point was to step into another universe, a universe of true straight lines, right angles, and other geometric abstractions. Louis stared hypnotized into the vanishing point. Which point was it, the source or the sink? Did the black wall emerge or vanish in that meeting place? From out of the point at infinity, something came at them. It was a ledge, growing like another abstraction along the base of the rim wall. First the ledge appeared, then, mounted on the ledge, a row of upright rings. Straight at the liar they came, straight at the bridge of Louis's nose. Louis shut his eyes and threw his arms up to protect his head. He heard a whimper of fear. Death should have come in that instant. When it didn't, he opened his eyes. The rings were going by in a steady stream, and he realized that they were no more than 50 miles across. Nessus was curled in a ball. Teela, her palms pressed flat against the transparent hull, was staring avidly outward. Speaker was fearless and attentive at the control board. Perhaps he was better than Louis at judging distance. Or perhaps he was faking it. The whimper could have come from Speaker. Nessus uncurled. He looked out at the rings, which were smaller now, converging.
Speaker, you must match velocities with the ring world. Hold us in position by thrusting at one gravity. We must inspect this.
Centrifugal force is an illusion, a manifestation of the law of inertia. Reality is centripetal force, a force applied at right angles to the velocity vector of a mass. The mass resists, tends to move in its accustomed straight line. By reason of its velocity and the law of inertia, the ring world tended to fly apart. Its rigid structure would not allow that. The ring world applied its own centrifugal force to itself. The lyre, matching speed at 770 miles per second, had to match that centripetal force. Speaker matched it. The lyre hovered next to the rim wall, balanced on 0.992G of thrust, while her crew inspected the spaceport. The spaceport was a narrow ledge, so narrow as to be a dimensionless line until Speaker moved the ship inward. Then it was wide, wide enough to dwarf a pair of tremendous spacecraft. The craft were flat-nosed cylinders, both of the same design. An unfamiliar design, yet clearly the design of a fusion ram ship. These ships were intended to fuel themselves, picking up interstellar hydrogen in scoops of electromagnetic force. One had been cannibalized for parts, so that it stood with its guts open to vacuum and its intimate structure exposed to alien eyes. Windows showed around the upper rim of the intact ship, allowing those eyes to gauge that ship's size. In the random starlight, the glitter of windows was precisely like crystal candy sprinkled on a cake. Thousands of windows. That ship was big. And it was dark. The entire spaceport was dark. Perhaps the beings who used it did not need light in the visible frequencies. But to Louis Wu, the spaceport looked abandoned.
"I don't understand the rings," said Teela.
"Electromagnetic cannon," Louis answered absently, "for takeoffs."
"No," said Nessus.
"Oh?"
"The cannon must have been intended for landing the ships. One can even surmise the method used. The ship must go into orbit alongside the rim wall. It will not attempt to match the ring's velocity, but will position itself 25 miles from the base of the rim wall. As the ring rotates, the coils of the electromagnetic cannon will scoop up the ship and accelerate it to match the velocity of the ring. I compliment the ring engineers. The ship need never come close enough to the ring to be dangerous."
"You could also use the ring for takeoff."
"No, observe the facility to our left."
"I'll be tonged," said Louis Wu. The facility was little more than a trap door big enough to hold one of the ram ships. It figured. 770 miles per second was ram scoop speed. The ring's launching facility was merely a structure for tumbling the ship off into the void. The pilot would immediately accelerate away on ram scoop fusion power. The spaceport facility seems to be abandoned, said Speaker.
Is there power in use?
My instruments sense none. There are no anomalous hotspots, no large-scale electromagnetic activities. As for the sensors which operate the linear accelerator, they may use less power than we can sense.
Your suggestion?
The facilities may still be in operational condition. We can test this by proceeding to the mouth of the linear accelerator and entering.
Nessus curled himself into a ball.
Wouldn't work, said Louis. There could be a key signal to start the thing, and we don't know it. It might react only to a metal hull. If we tried to go through the cannon at the speed of the ring world, we'd hit one of the coils and blow everything to bits.
I have flown ships under similar conditions during simulated war maneuvers.
How long ago?
Perhaps too long. Never mind. Your suggestion?
The underside, said Louis. The puppeteer uncurled at once. They hovered beneath the ringworld floor, matching velocities, thrusting outward at 9.94 meters per second. Spotlights, said Nessus. The spots reached across 500,000 miles, but if their light touched the back of the ring, it did not return. The spots were for landings.
Do you still trust your engineers, Nessus?
They should have anticipated this contingency.
But I did. I can light the ring world if I may use the fusion drives, said the Kazin.
Do so.
Speaker used all four, the pair facing forward and the larger motors facing back. But on the forward pair, the pair intended for emergency braking and possibly for weapons, Speaker choked the nozzle wide open. Hydrogen flowed through the tube too fast, emerged half-burnt. Fusion tube temperature dropped until the exhaust, usually hotter than the core of a nova, was as cool as the surface of a yellow dwarf star. Light thrust forward in twin spears to fall across the black underside of the ring world. First, the underside was not flat. It dipped and rose. There were bulges and indentations.
I thought it would be smooth, said Tila.
Sculptured, said Louis. I'll make you a bet. Wherever we see a bulge, there's a sea on the sunlit side. Where we see a dent, there's a mountain.
But the formations were tiny, unnoticeable until Speaker drew the ship close.
The lying bastard drifted in from the ringworld's edge, 500,000 miles beneath her underbelly. Sculptured bulges and sculptured indentations, they drifted by, irregular, somehow pleasing. For many centuries, excursion boats had drifted in like manner across the surface of Earth's moon. The effect here was much the same. Airless pits and peaks, sharp-edged blacks and whites, exposed on the moon's dark side by the powerful spotlights carried by all such boats. Yet there was a difference. At any height above the moon, you could always see the lunar horizon, sharp and toothy against black space and gently curved. There were no teeth in the ringworld's horizon, and no curves. It was a straight line, a geometer's line, unimaginably distant, barely visible as black against black. How could Speaker stand it, Louis wondered. Hour after hour, driving the lyre across and beneath the belly of this artifact. Louis shuddered. Gradually, he was learning the size, the scale of the ringworld. It was unpleasant, like all learning processes. He drew his eyes away from that terrible horizon, back to the illuminated area below, above them.
Nessus said, "All the seas seem to be of the same order of magnitude."
"I've seen a few ponds," Tila contradicted him. "And look, there's a river. It has to be a river. But I haven't seen any big oceans."
Seas there were in plenty, Louis saw, if he was right and those flat bulges were seas. Though they were not all the same size, they seemed evenly distributed, so that no region was without water. And
flat. All the seas have flattened bottoms.
Yes, said Nessus.
That proves it. All the seas are shallow. The ringworlders aren't sea dwellers. They use only the top of an ocean, like us.
But all the seas have squiggly shapes, said Tila, and the edges are always ragged. You know what that means.
Bays, all the bays anyone can use.
Though your ringworlders are land dwellers, they do not fear boats, said Nessus, else they would not need the bays. Louis, these people will resemble humans in outlook. Kzinti hate water, and my species fears to drown.